Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. Today we're going to be talking to someone who's an expert on some aspect of chemistry. He's particularly interested in something called mass spectrometry, and you might think, what on earth is this? Why should we listen for the next 28 minutes to this? So, Russell, who's our guest this week?
We're very happy to welcome to Science Studio Professor Mike Ketterer. He's at the Department of Chemistry and Biochemistry at Northern Arizona University in Flagstaff. Welcome to Science Studio, Mike.
Thanks very much.
How did you get into science? What were those little moments when you were a young kid that made you realize, or other people realize perhaps, that you were cut out to be a scientist?
Well, I think it was reading and discovering the natural world and poking around in the outdoors. I grew up in western New York near Buffalo, and I'd like to wander around in the woods and look at rocks and
you did that
plants
in the summer,
and things
as I
like
recall.
That. Yeah, mostly in the winter I looked at snow.
Right.
You know,
the lake
sort of
effect
thing.
Snow. I mean, Buffalo seemed to get more snow than the rest of the country.
Indeed. But I think that there was a formative event when I was about 9 years old. I went to a garage sale and I found this book. It was 10 cents, and I had 10 cents in those days. And it was by Isaac Asimov, The World of Carbon, just a thin little paperback book. And I went and I got that, and I read that. And all of a sudden, I knew all these things about hydrocarbons and the structure of organic compounds. And that was pretty much it. I set my mind on being a chemist at about that age.
Wow. And to whom did you talk about this discovery at 9 or 10? Were your parents sort of conversant with
this? Yeah, my dad was an electrical engineer, and he had the idea that, chemist was a pretty good thing to be. And, you, of course, needed to become educated. That was presumed that you were going to college in my family and so on. My mom had this silly idea that I was going to become a doctor or a physician, and I wanted no part of that, and I saw, no reason to go down that avenue, and she was all about, oh, well, your cousin Tom is going to be a doctor, and he's going to be so wealthy and all this. But I was really enthralled by science, and I really liked the courses I took. I went to kind of a parochial prep school, and I took courses in earth sciences and chemistry and biology and physics, AP courses. I took plenty of that. And then when I was 16 years old, they threw me out and said, you need to go to university.
Where?
At University of Notre Dame. By my build that I played football.
Anyway, so but yeah. So you went to Notre Dame.
Yeah.
How was that? I mean, you were Catholic?
I was raised as a Catholic, yeah, right. And I'm still a practicing Catholic, okay. Too, for the most part. I would say Notre Dame, I got a very, very good undergraduate education at. Socially, I'm not so sure I fit in so well to the culture of the school. I was being funny by saying I played football.
Oh, yeah.
I was as far away from a jock as you can imagine. I was like one of these kids that you see with the glasses with tape on them and a calculator in their pocket and a pen protector and that sort of thing. I was kind of like that. And I was the kid that the business majors all came to for help with their calculus homework,
And then where did you go to graduate school?
I went from there to University of Colorado in Boulder, and that was a night and day different kind of experience, Okay. And I had a good time in graduate school. I liked the social life in graduate school. I got along well with my fellow students. I liked the town and so on. I developed some other interests like music and bicycle riding and skiing and things like that. I had a life. And
right.
Maybe I enjoyed myself a little bit too much because it took me 5 years rather than 4 years to complete my PhD. But it's all
now,
okay.
That's almost the norm nowadays,
yeah.
Anyways.
Well, by the end, I was being prodded quite a lot by my research advisor.
What did you study? What was the research that you were doing?
Well, I was an electrochemist. So officially, I was an analytical chemist in the analytical chemistry division, but I was studying electrochemistry, which is all about how electrons get transferred between matter and between electrode surfaces and molecules out in solution. And electrochemists were a strange breed. It was very, very interesting to me, but towards the end of graduate school, I kind of determined that I would not really make a career in electrochemistry.
Did you work with batteries at all when you were electrochemist? I knew
actually,
they were hot back then.
I finished my PhD in 1985, and I said to myself, oh, good God, I need a job. The fun days of being a student are over. So I got a job in Denver at the Gates Corporation, which is better known for rubber and tires and things like that. But they had a Gates Energy Products division, and I worked in R&D. We did a lot of work on lead acid batteries and other types of rechargeable battery systems. So I put some of that electrochemistry to use, and it was, as you may imagine, night and day different to go from, you know, being in the university setting to being in a company when there's totally different ideals in how, about, you know, how things work and how you're supposed to spend.
So how long were you there at Gates? I'm quite familiar with Gates and what they were doing and some of the researchers. How long were you there?
I was there 2 years.
And you changed your mind about industry?
Well, I would say, you know, I see the purpose to industry, but in general, I was always conflicted while I was there because I had two problems with it. One was that I couldn't do what I wanted. And the second problem was is I had to do what they wanted. But I survived okay.
That just about sums up an attitude I think a lot of people have.
Yeah.
It's probably not a good attitude, but I mean, you stated it very cogently.
Well, it's, you know, it's kind of diametrically opposed to science. And the spirit of being a scientist is, I think.
Well, I have to say that, you know, I worked at Exxon Research Corporate Labs, and there it was. The vice president who comes out here and visits us, started the lab, said, "I'm hiring you. Go in and do something useful for the company." And it was complete freedom to do that. And however, when you got something, boy, they really came down on you. But there are industrial labs that really emphasize science.
I think Gates was very pragmatic. You know, it was kind of engineering was the driver. They wanted to take ideas that were pretty close to fruition. They didn't want new discoveries from the ground up. They wanted to take ideas that were pretty close to fruition and make them into marketable products. And that's completely understandable.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that.
No, absolutely not.
But it wasn't for you. So then you found a faculty position.
Well, later on I did. So then I left in 1987. I left Gates and I started working for US EPA. And I worked for US EPA for 6 years. So this is also in Denver. And I became more of an analytical and environmental chemist. And I worked at a place called NEIC, National Enforcement Investigation Center, in Denver. And it was sort of like EPA's regulatory laboratory. So we did spook science in the environmental science world. And our clients were criminal investigators and FBI people and attorney generals and
Now, this sounds really interesting.
It was.
What years were that, by the way?
87 to 93.
Okay. So you were doing that while I was working with the EPA in the Alaska oil spill.
Aha.
Do you remember that?
I personally did not work on that. But our job was to develop evidence from work in a chemical laboratory to develop evidence that the agency could use in litigation, civil and criminal litigation. So I did a lot of work on the civil litigation side, and the typical case involved, well, we got to figure out where these hazardous substances come from. You know, there's all this lead out here in the environment. Where did this lead come from? So trying to take the P out of PRP. A PRP, you see, is a potentially responsible party. Well, we wanted to turn that potentially responsible party into a responsible party. So we would develop evidence from that. And that's where I got into a lot of the analytical work that I still do with mass spectrometry.
Before we get to that, yes. You often then an expert witness. Did you often have to go on the stand, so to speak?
I did some of that,
yes. Did you enjoy that?
Generally, no. Being in court was not actually so bad because the judge was there to make sure that the attorneys behaved. But what was really nasty is when they had when they took your deposition.
Offline, so to
say. Yeah. Well, it was in the presence of a court reporter in a little padded cell. Yeah, rather like this one, you know. Right. You'd be on one side of the table and here'd be this 28-year-old kid who's the government's attorney, and lined up on the other side of the table would be six or eight sharks who were, you know, law partners at these big companies working for the PRPs.
Right. And who knew very little about science.
Yeah, I have to respect the level of not only knowledge but common sense that these people would have, the opposing attorneys.
You know, the question I have is working with the EPA, we're partners in the oil spill. was a lot of the people working for the EPA, you were saying before, well, there's a lot of lead around here. Where does it come from? That many of the answers that they were coming up with, even they were sort of uncertain about. It was very difficult to really pin somebody, so to speak.
Well, yeah, I agree that there's always going to be some uncertainty in the final picture, and there will always be, you know, sources that are not identified that actually are there. But what we were often trying to do was more qualitative in nature. We wanted to prove that somebody or other was actually, in fact, a contributor to the total contamination. And this was guided in part by the way the law was written. We were working on Superfund, or as it's known, CERCLA. And CERCLA says that, you know, if the government can prove that this particular entity is a contributor, and of course, if they have deep pockets are always important. If they are a contributor, then they can be under joint and several liability. They can be held liable for the whole thing. So the government would go after the deep pockets where possible and try and say, okay, well, your company or your predecessor company contributed something to this contamination. Therefore, you're going to pay.
I mean, that brings up to move into segue into what you do. A lot of, for example, in the case of lead, quite often you use isotope analysis, that each element has got different sets of isotopes, and a particular ore or a particular use of lead can have its own sort of fingerprint.
Yes.
And so that leads us into and segue into the whole concept of isotope analysis, because each sample will have its own fingerprint. And we'll get into that when we come back. You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, and Mike Ketterer from Northern Arizona University. And we'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Niesel. Just for fun, try testing your musical aptitude. See if you can identify this musical note.
I know, it's an A.
Ugh, of course you know, it's in the script. Anyway, yes, that was an A. And only 1 in 10,000 people can instantaneously identify or sing any given musical note without help.
And almost always, people with perfect pitch had musical training before the age of 7. But not every young musician ends up with the skill because it may be in their genes. Musicians with perfect pitch include Mozart and Mariah Carey, while those who don't include Bernstein, Julie Andrews, and many others.
Scientists have long suspected perfect pitch runs in families, and ongoing research supports that. For example, compare two people with early musical training, and the person whose sibling has perfect pitch is 15 times more likely to also have it.
A recent study used DNA from 73 families to identify regions of DNA related to the inheritance of perfect pitch. They were actually able to link a region on chromosome 8 to perfect pitch, but surprisingly, only in families of mixed European heritage.
The chromosomal location was different in families of East Asian descent as well as Ashkenazi Jewish families who are more likely to have perfect pitch. What seems clear is the trait involves different genes, and scientists are now sequencing the ones identified in these families to understand how they work.
But some people still think perfect pitch can be learned because they believe it's a form of speech. One study found people with perfect pitch were better at recalling speech sounds read to them.
So maybe there's hope for someone tone deaf like me.
Good luck with that, Dave. We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more on this and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, Mike Ketterer from Northern Arizona University, talking about analysis and how you can do mass spectrometry, which you'll explain, to sort of analyze samples and get some idea of providence. So, Mike, tell us just very quickly about mass spectrometry and then what you're doing with it.
Well, mass spectrometry is a technique for counting gas phase atoms or molecules or fragments of molecules and distinguishing them by mass. And what I do with it is generally counting individual atoms. So we take a sample, we convert it into a liquid, we dissolve something, we put it into this high-temperature gas plasma that's sort of like a metal-cutting plasma, and the atoms turn into vapor, and then they acquire charge, and then they go into a mass spectrometer where they're separated according to their mass-to-charge ratio, which is really just mass. So, for example, lead has four different nuclear forms. They're all chemically lead, but there's four different stable forms that have different masses, 204, 206, 207, and 208 atomic mass units. And the mass spectrometer can distinguish these, and it can count how many of each you have. And so we measure not only how much lead do you have, but the relative proportions of these nuclear forms, which we call isotopes. So this is isotope ratio analysis. Well, I stumbled into this kind of by accident. I got a job at EPA in fall of 1987. They had this new toy that was called an ICP mass spectrometer, inductively coupled plasma mass spectrometer. And my boss there, he was kind of a snarky guy. He said, "Hey, you got to go in there and make something useful happen. This machine is becoming an embarrassment. We've had it for a year, and all these people from Washington are coming by and looking in the window, and nothing is coming out of it. Go in there. You're a bright young PhD. Go in there and make something useful happen." So I started learning about this particular instrument, got some sense of what it could do. I did some reading on lead and isotope geology of lead and that sort of thing. And then, you know, sometimes things just happen by serendipity. I stumbled into a very lucky break. There was this attorney coming from Washington, the Department of Justice, and he had this big hot lead case. Where's the lead coming from in northern Idaho, up in the Coeur d'Alene lead belt in the Bunker Hill smelter? So I talked to them, and I took just a lucky guess. I said, "Well, I think we can apply some of this isotope ratio fingerprinting to that." And it worked phenomenally well. And we made that case with that.
Well, let's go back a little bit now. You talked there are four isotopes of lead, right?
Right.
I assume that they don't always occur in the same ratio, and that difference tells you where it comes from?
That's true, yes.
So that if you have an ore nearby, that'll have a different ratio than an ore that's on the West Coast or something like that?
Yeah, it's characteristic, not necessarily distinctive of where something came from, not necessarily uniquely characteristic. But to give you an example about this Bunker Hill site, near Bunker Hill, which is in the panhandle of northern Idaho, there's very, very old lead ores. They're on the order of 1.2 billion years old. And these ores have a certain signature. We measure 206 over 204 as an atom ratio or isotope ratio, and that's about 16.2 in these ores. And all the mine tailings in that whole valley, they all have approximately that fingerprint. Well, the Bunker Hill smelter ran out of lead ores in the 1940s and 1950s, so they started importing stuff from all around the world. Missouri, South America, Utah, Colorado, who knows where. And a lot of these ores that they imported had different signatures. So we'd go in the soil near the smelter and we'd measure the lead there. And, it was quite contaminated.
But it's not the natural lead is what you're going to say.
Right.
It's from the area.
Right. It's not the lead that's from the area that matches the tailings, that matches the local ore body. Instead, we would measure ratios 206, 204. That would be about 18.2. And this is a composite of all sorts of other stuff. There is some tailings mixed in there, but this ratio that we measure sort of shows a mixture of – it's a weighted average of where did all the lead come from. You have one piece of information that can tell you something about several possible sources. You may not be able to spell out particular exactly what the sources had to be, but you can say, well, it can't be 100% this. So the company, the PRP at that time, was saying, oh, well, all the contamination is all of this old mining stuff that occurred in the 19th century.
So did that follow through, the deep pockets? Did they have to pay? Or
Eventually it was settled. I left EPA in 1993, and this thing was still going on, and Department of Justice was still immersed in it, and eventually it was settled.
Is there any sort of knowledge about the ancient geology, why the ratios changed? Do we know that? Or?
Yeah, I'm not a geologist really, but my understanding of that is it has to do with the production of three of the lead isotopes from decay of uranium and thorium. And so you got uranium-238 decaying eventually to lead-206, and the other two lead isotopes, 207, 208, also come from uranium and thorium decay. And depending upon how old the ore is and when the lead became separated as a lead mineral. Lead is usually present as galena, lead sulfide, and it excludes uranium. When it crystallizes, it excludes uranium and thorium. So the ratios are kind of frozen in time. So it's more or less understood, yes.
Let's move on then to what it is you do now. This was obviously the entry into using mass spectrometry, metals. What are you doing now? Because I understand you're working with nuclides, radioactive nuclides like plutonium, for
yes.
example.
Well, I've continued to work. I've been teaching now for almost 20 years. I taught for 5 years at John Carroll University in Cleveland and then 15 years now at NAU, and I've continued to work with this mass spectrometry. And over the last 10 years or so, I've become interested in nuclear forensics and essentially doing the same thing using isotope fingerprints. We do quite a lot of work on uranium and finding out where does uranium come from in the environment. Is it naturally occurring? Is it anthropogenic? Is it from some kind of enriched or depleted uranium source? And we're also doing some work with plutonium, and we measure all of these by mass spectrometry. We count the atoms, and we measure how much do you have, and the ratio or fingerprint is also measured. So, for example, we did some work and published it a few years ago where we looked at soils in Poland, and we could see that the soil in Poland was a mixture of stuff that was from global fallout from the 50s and 60s nuclear weapons tests deposition from the stratosphere. That was being mixed with local or regional fallout from the Chernobyl accident. And these plutonium signatures were isotopically different. I've also
people would like to know. I mean, it sounds all common sense. Now, when you have lead tailings, there's a whole lot of lead.
Yes.
But there isn't very much plutonium in the soil, even, you know, around in Poland. What's the levels that you can go down to? Just give the audience a clue of what you're really talking about. Just tiny, tiny concentrations.
The concentrations are indeed pretty small. So if we go to the Earth's surface somewhere in the northern hemisphere, typical concentration is maybe 1 picogram per gram of plutonium. So that's a part per trillion by mass. And the concentrations are actually quite small. The level of radioactivity from that is far smaller than from the naturally occurring uranium nuclides. But we can measure it. We extract this from the soil. We pre-concentrate it in the laboratory by passing it through polymers that selectively retain the plutonium, and then we get small volumes of nectar extracted from the samples and put those into the mass spectrometer. So,
do you need special permission, or is it just that you've got such low concentrations that working as you do nominally with plutonium is not a safety issue?
I don't think it's that much of a safety issue. You don't want to drink the sample, and you don't want to get it on your skin. It's an alpha emitter. Most of the isotopes are alpha emitters, so they're only internal hazards. We have a radioactive materials license because we have to buy standard solutions, and we add certain standard solutions to our sample to use as tracers. But primarily, you just have to kind of be willing to do it in your laboratory, and it's not extremely hard.
You know, there's an interesting example that I remember being back at Exxon was that the anthracite coal that was being burned on the East Coast actually was considered a tertiary source of uranium, and that the coal burning plants could not pass the radioactive emissions that a nuke had to.
I've read a bit about uranium and fly ash being emitted by coal-fired power plants, and on a mass balance basis, you know, the concentrations are not that high in the fly ash, but there's so much of it. There's millions of tons of this fly ash going into the air globally, and so there's I think that that's true, that there's significant sources of this going into the atmosphere and then being deposited on the Earth's surface.
Do we actually know naturally how much uranium is really dangerous? One atom, 10 million atoms, you know, breathing it every day? Or is that something that stay away from it, period?
But you can't. I mean,
no, you can't.
The drinking water everywhere in the world is full of uranium at some level.
Right.
In fact, there's a theory. We've done a program with somebody, some biology fellow that said, in fact, that radioactive, yeah, we need it because our body's grown up with this little bit of emission, and it's good for us.
Yeah, I remember Linus Pauling was saying something like that.
Well, I'm not a toxicologist, so I don't really know what levels could be considered safe. There's different theories on that. There's the theory of None is safe. There's a theory that there's a threshold below which it is relatively innocuous. I tend to think that, look, life has grown up for several billion years
around
natural radioactivity.
And we're all living longer than we ever did. So
yeah.
Let's change the subject.
Yeah.
Okay. You're the university ombudsman at Northern Arizona University. Tell our audience what's an ombudsman and what do you actually do in the university setting? And why don't we all have such a person?
An ombudsperson is an individual who serves as kind of a counselor or facilitator for people within the organization who have work-related problems that they want to talk about. And we follow the practice of the International Ombuds Association, which has four tenets: neutrality, confidentiality, independence, and informality. And those
sounds like fair and balanced.
Yeah, those words are relatively self-explanatory as to what we do, but people call me, and it's always off the record. We always have off the record chats, and we discuss their problem. I listen actively. I ask them questions, and then what I try to do is help that individual formulate options for their path forward in this problem. In my practice, I do this half-time. So this is half of my job. The other half is being a normal chemistry faculty person. But in this half of my job, I meet with faculty in person or by phone, and I listen and I try to help them.
Can you
formulate.
Give us an example of a problem you might be involved in?
The chair wants me to teach double what I think I should teach. There's conflicts over workloads, or another example is, you know, this or that person is a dirty so-and-so and is a
or
bully.
Space.
Yeah, space. It's the usual kinds of conflicts. You know, universities, the politics can be so savage because we have so little to fight over.
That's right.
But
you say it's a half-time job.
Yes.
Do you actually spend half your time doing this? Is there that much work for an ombudsman at Northern Arizona University?
It varies. It's sporadic. The last 3 or 4 weeks, it has become quite busy. There's a couple of situations going on where I have repeat contacts from the same individual. Sometimes it's the same people bugging you over and over again. Sometimes it's very quiet. It's quite sporadic. I think on average, it's close to halftime. I have to do certain other things associated with the ombuds practice. I read books and I go to meetings and that sort of thing.
So is there a National Ombudsman Association?
Yes, there's the International Ombuds Association, and I'm not quite sure whether I'm going to go, but they have a conference in Miami in April.
For example, tenure. I mean, this is the time of the year where people are beginning to worry about getting tenure or not tenure. Does that come within the bailiwick of the ombudsman, or is that on another level beyond?
Sometimes. There's a certain number of the visits or complaints have to do with personnel action types of matters,
okay,
like evaluations,
right,
and promotions and tenure. So sometimes I see that.
Well, that's the end of Science Studio, Mike. We appreciate you being here very much.
Thanks
Come
very
again.
Much.
Yeah, thanks very much. We hope to have you back for another show in which we'll have some lawyers present.
Uh-oh.
And thanks to Norma Martinez, our producer.
And thanks to those lawyers out there listening to the program. Take care, and we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
I'm Noemi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. Texas Tech's University Breast Care Center recently received national accreditation. That makes it the only nationally accredited breast care program in El Paso. Dr. Manuel de la Rosa, founding dean of the Paul Foster School of Medicine, praised the achievement at a recent gathering, calling it yet another milestone in bringing higher standards of health care to El Paso. Read more in the region's Life Sciences News Digest. Go to mcasynapse.org.